The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Orthodox Nationalist. Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson is a former professor, a professional writer, and a priest of the Ukrainian Orthodox Church. His website is rusjournal.com. That's rusjournal.com. Now here's your host, Matt Johnson.
Hey, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. Today we're going to deal with Putin's reforms of national defense since his takeover of the presidency in 99, and really the nature of Putin's defense doctrine. And this is a defense doctrine, I think, that is going to define Russian military policy, really, probably for the next generation. I actually used to teach a whole course on the Russian defense ministry and its basic strategy in the Putin era. There's a lot of material here to cover. When Putin comes to power, he comes to power very soon, becoming one of the most popular politicians in all of Europe. He comes to power, though, out of the intelligence community. And so he has a general vision of how he wants to reorganize Russian defenses and Russian military policy, at least over the next generation or so. He will divide Russia into several military districts. He will organize these separate districts with a specific mission in mind. And I think the division of the districts and each district having an envoy, a presidential envoy attached to it, is one of the most central parts of Putin's reforms. The military districts are the following. Northern Russia, let me put it this way. You start with Leningrad, and this is very European-oriented, and then you go to Moscow, which is centered around the Security Council. Then you go to the southwest, which is a military district dealing with Georgia, and then Central Asia, should include the southern Volga and the Ural Mountains, and then the two closely related districts, Siberia and the Far East. Each one of these is specializing really in a specific question. The Leningrad units specialize in any European threats. Moscow is the policy center, of course. Georgia, in the southwest and Central Asia are generally dealing with terrorism and drugs. And the Siberian and Far East, area is generally dealing with, the Chinese, issue, as well as any other issues coming, really, and also the protection of the oil and mining interests in that part of the world. And so these eight military districts are absolutely central to Vladimir Putin's reforms of military doctrine. Now, I mentioned something called the presidential envoy. The envoys are meant to communicate the and this is a way to keep commanders from becoming exceptionally independent. It's a way of maintaining some kind of central control over the military forces. And even, you know, pretty hardcore decentralizers like myself certainly believe that a generally popular president should permit, now prime minister of course, should have full control over military forces. And they have several jobs. The presidential envoy has been a substantial reform, as a way of really maintaining the independence of these districts, but making certain that this independence is based on, the basic needs of the country as a whole. And of course, that's a difficult balance. The envoys are to coordinate, policy coming from Moscow with military forces in these districts at all levels. The envoys are also major bearers of intelligence information, and they're able to kind of grease the skids for financing. And now that Russia has been running a budget surplus for a long time now, a trade surplus for a long time, there's a lot of cash there now that can be funneled into the different needs of these military districts. And the presidential envoy is really designed to come to some understanding as to the financial needs of these districts. And these financial needs, of course, are dependent also upon the specific mission that's attached to each district. And they're very different. Russia, basically straddles the globe. And as a result, each envoy will have a different specialization, as will the command structure in each of the military districts. The envoy also is meant to maintain civilian control over the military forces at all times. There's also a strong sense of burden sharing, where in terms of intelligence and basic policy, the envoy is meant to transmit information from the locality to Moscow, and then also the response from Moscow to the locality. There is also, and this is actually very important, we're going to talk about this in a little bit, but what's very important is that there is a move from the Ministry of the Interior to the Ministry of Defense. Back in the old days, the Ministry of the Interior really controlled the KGB, which was a state in and of itself. That has radically changed. I mean, not only has the KGB been purged many times from Yeltsin onward, but the old Ministry of the Interior, a lot of its functions are being transferred to the Ministry of Defense, which is more securely under the control of the civilian power. The envoys also are in charge of military reserves in terms of manpower and money. And so they have this basic role in terms of intelligence and communication, which is absolutely central to any defense doctrine. Of course, the Russian military straddling such areas as Central Asia and the Caucasus are reformatting some basic training to refer more to the unconventional style of warfare. Fighting the organized crime movements, both of Jewish and Islamic background, and the terror cells that exist throughout the Caucasus, and I believe many of them have CIA money, and also the Department of Defense, or the Ministry of Defense, I should say, is involved in training local police in dealing with these questions. At the same time, Putin has made it clear from 2000 to the present day that there must be a very, very strong sense of demarcation in terms of function in all of these of all of these organizations. So, number one, I think the big issue is that nuclear deterrence is really at the center of this new military doctrine. Putin's idea is that there really is no need to build new nuclear weapons. What needs to be done is that we have first-class professional maintenance of the existing nuclear weapons. And in terms of scientific doctrine, the Putin government, even to the present day, has strongly stressed guidance systems and really the high-tech side of these weapons above and beyond the actual multiplication of all of these things. And, there is a sense that that there should be a cooperation between the U.S. and Russia in space. And Putin has made it clear that if the U.S. is going to continue to build this missile shield, the Russian scientific establishment has to be involved in developing the concept of penetrating this missile shield. So, overwhelmingly, the Putin administration really wants to, and it is one thing that the Soviet Union did very well, is produce this scientific elite that now that, that the Russian government is awash in dollars and other currencies, the cash is now present to pay a top-notch scientific establishment, in some cases trained in the United States, to stress the high-tech side of the Russian military over manpower. So this is the nature of this reform, the division of military policy into these districts, and the connection of the district commanders with Moscow through the presidential envoy. And the presidential envoy is really meant to not simply be an agent of the central government, but also to be an advocate for the local district and its particular needs. So this is the absolute center of the Russian approach to defense doctrine in the post-Cold War era. This is something that Yeltsin really didn't have the capability or the mentality or the tolerance to alcohol necessary to really, you know, create this kind of a military doctrine. And he was incapable of it. Putin, of course, coming from the intelligence services, is very much concerned with strategy and doctrine and how to integrate military forces with the specific needs of the various Russian regions. Okay. When I used to lecture on these topics at the university level, I made 7 particular points concerning the nature of the Russian defense doctrine from the early 2000s to 2008-2009. And for the rest of this discussion, we're going to deal with these 7 points that are absolutely central in taking what I've now already said as the fundamentals of Putin's military reform and making sense out of it in actual practical terms. Okay, point number one. Putin has made it clear that all military reform has to center around one general concept, that the conflicts that the Russian military, Russian police forces, are going to have to tolerate come from local sources. They come from the drug lords of the Pansky Gorge in Georgia. They come from Islamic as well as Jewish terror cells throughout the southern part of the country. But, you know, they also come from threats from the West in the Leningrad military district. And the one positive thing I see from the Obama administration is that those threats have largely been reduced. And I know that some of my critics have said that, well, you know, Obama has just hired, you know, the Holbrooke movement and the neo-libs from the Clinton administration. But there's one big difference. The big difference is that the American forces are so tied down in Central Asia and the Middle East, not to mention the fact that there's simply no money in the American treasury here, that the neo-lib movement has now, over the last few years, defined itself as something over and above and very different from the neoconservative movement of John McCain. Now, the fact that, and we could only thank God for this, the defeat of the mentally unstable and, in my personal opinion, possessed John McCain, the one thing that we could thank God for here is that a lot of the threats to the Russian Federation are to some extent mitigated. And I'm willing to, and I don't care what you people say, I'm willing to work, you know, mentally speaking, with Obama to reduce the threats on the Russian Federation. And Obama's point of view is that the Russian Federation isn't the nasty enemy that McCain had always made it out to be. The very fact that McCain was financed almost exclusively by the big American and British and European oil firms strongly suggests that John McCain, of course, is, you know, a puppet of Jewish organized crime. There's no question about that. I refer you to Mike Piper for more information on that particular area. But that the American and European oil firms are very, very upset with this military reform, because much of it has to do with the protection of the pipelines. And so what the CIA has been doing, even under, and I think the CIA is basically, you know, totally autonomous under Obama and does whatever it wants, is now engaging in what is essentially guerrilla campaigns in the Caucasus and elsewhere against the Russian Federation. And so the first point here really deals with Putin's central project of synthesizing the local and the national in terms of military policy, anti-terror policy. There is real terror that exists in southern Russia against Russian interests. And these, to some extent, are Israeli-backed, to a great extent American-backed, and who knows what oligarchical money is still left in that part of the world that can finance guerrilla organizations against Putin and against Russia and against the Orthodox Church in all of these areas. So that's point number one. Point number two is the coordination and even in some sense the integration of the Ministry of Defense and the Ministry of the Interior. Putin really does want to negate the old Soviet MOI independence. The Ministry of the Interior was completely independent of anybody else. And to some extent, the MOD and MOI really were two different states constantly jockeying for position and power. There's no doubt that as an insider, Putin is aware of this kind of jockeying for power and wants to coordinate in general and integrate in certain areas anyway the functions of the MOD and MOI. And one of the great weaknesses of the Soviet Union is that these two institutions, very powerful, were really two states. They were two governments that functioned at loggerheads with each other. And to finance themselves, these two agencies, the Defense Department, which it would include, of course, Army, Navy, Air Force, and the Interior, which would include the KGB and all kinds of local border police and border control, and they would essentially invest in local industry. And that's how they would finance their operations. Okay. The third point concerns the Border Corps. The Border Troops, or the FBTS, is a unit dedicated to sealing the border from drugs, terror, prostitution, all of these movements financed largely by Mossad and CIA, penetrating Russian space. The Border Troops have been, and I guess, you know, as of this talk, I guess the Border Troops are still involved in really reforming themselves to make of themselves an intelligence agency in and of their own organization and their own specialty concerning the borders of the Russian Federation, Russian Empire, including the Caucasus and Central Asia. Really one of the first the first real policy of the border force is infiltration. And this is, you know, an intelligence operation where the border troops and their intelligence forces that are attached here, now border troops are connected to the MOI, their first job is to infiltrate any kind of drug running or terror organizations on Russia's borders. Their second mission is to guard industrial installations. And this is the case really throughout all of the border regions of Russia from Finland all the way to China. That in industrial installations, including mining and oil installations, are guarded by the FBTS, the border forces, who have a particular intelligence gathering service to the terror and drug running organizations in these parts of the world. And of course, intelligence is absolutely central. The Border Corps, the FBTS, also has, as part of its portfolio, the use of terror tactics within areas occupied by enemy forces. And Putin has made no bones about this. We will use whatever it takes to defend our borders and defend our people, and we will form organizations that will engage the enemy on their own territory and with their own methods. So they will use guerrilla tactics and are trained in guerrilla tactics for these border regions of the Russian Federation. And as a part of that, the disruption of communications amongst these gangs, regardless of who is financing them, whether Mossad, whether MI6, or whether they're autonomous, however they function, the disruption of communications is now going to be one of the central areas of the portfolio of the border troops and the FPTS. And of course, lastly, harassing the supply lines of drug, prostitution, terror cells throughout Central Asia and the Caucasus. And so the FPTS has a substantial portfolio. They are essentially the counter-terror organizations, both in terms of actual military force, shooting, you know, and explosive force, as well as intelligence, espionage, and penetration into these areas. So that's the purpose of the FBTS. And the border corps, Putin really, by the way, some of my friends know this, but the Cossacks of the Caucasus and parts of Ukraine are being used as the central core of these border. Remember, there's 1.5 million Cossacks in southern Russia and Ukraine. And as a result, you have highly trained elite forces that can now be called upon by the Russian government, can be paid properly, can be treated properly, and used to seal the borders with this portfolio that the FPTS now has. And I think it's very impressive. It's a shame that the American government doesn't have this confidence in its own border corps, which is always underfunded and really is given no respect. But in the Russian case, Putin has made certain that the border troops are absolutely central to Russian defense reform and Russian defense doctrine. So we're going to take a break now, and when we come back, we are going to finish up really the big issues in the Russian defense reform, with issues of the Ministry of the Interior, the basic security services, and the basic policies of the Russian military reform under Vladimir Putin. So hang in there. We will be right back.
Don't go away, because there's more to come on the Orthodox Nationalist. You're listening to the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network. Visit us at reasonradionetwork.com. Let's return to the Orthodox Nationalist, brought to you by the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network, reasonradionetwork.com.
My friends, welcome back to the Orthodox Nationalist, where we are dealing with something that I, you know, years ago used to spend an awful lot of time on. And because I could read Russian decently well, I'm able to actually read this stuff in the original. I don't know how much of this kind of stuff is available in English. If I had a grant, I could translate some of this into English, because it's certainly worthwhile. But until that money comes through, I guess it's not going to happen. We're talking about Russian defense reformation under Putin. Putin comes to power in 1999, really in an extremely unenviable position. For all of you who are listening to me who don't like Vladimir Putin, I want you at least to respect the fact that this man comes to power looking at a third world economy dominated by a Jewish Western supported clique of oligarchs, where the overwhelming majority, especially of the older generation, is completely impoverished. Putin comes to power having to deal with the legitimate rage of the Russian and Slavic populations that have seen their society absolutely humiliated and dominated by an alien clique. And then within the space of a few years, rebuilds the infrastructure. And I don't just mean, you know, the physical infrastructure, but the emotional and spiritual infrastructure of the country in such a way that it's no longer a third world country. The Russian economy has now just surpassed that of Canada and is now more or less a first world economy. And it's taken quite a bit of work to make that happen, but to some extent, this military reform is kind of the backbone of all of these other reforms. Reforming, and you know, making matters worse for Putin is that he comes on the heels of a laughably incompetent, out of control alcoholic, your perfect Western front man, you know, to let the oligarchs do whatever they want without, you know, and again, most of my listeners know that I believe in decentralized power. But when you're dealing with a state that's at this level of decay and humiliation, there's got to be reform at the center, especially when a weak center, like you had under Yeltsin, simply meant the domination of this Jewish oligarchical clique that dominated the society. So I want to say that this military reform, this isn't just a recitation of some dry, you know, some dry academic subject. The military reform of, let's say, the last decade has been really about creating a backbone that would, you know, that would support and function as a skeleton of all the other different reforms, you know, financial and economic and taxes and everything else. Putin, of course, puts imposes a flat tax on the Russian economy. I mean, we got to like him at least for that, people. I mean, you know, he instituted the flat tax in Russia as a way to spur investment. So, you know, he comes to power in 99, as Yeltsin is really kind of, you know, just barely hanging on, in a very unenviable position. But these military reforms, the first half of the 2000s, that, you know, this is sort of the foundational a coercive apparatus that will then be able to undergird everything else that he ends up doing in the realm of politics and morality and everything else. Okay. The Ministry of the Interior. This used to be the province of the KGB. Now, the KGB being involved in the coup to overthrow Yeltsin in the early 90s was radically purged. A lot of the old Soviet people were pensioned off. Buy them a house in the Crimea or something like that, you know, and pension them off there. That bunch is gone. And I want you guys, you refer to the, you know, FSB, KGB, you know, you don't know. The fact is that that bunch, the old Soviet crowd is gone. They were pensioned off under the Yeltsin system because Yeltsin thought, not to mention the old Army Corps, thought that this bunch could be a destabilizing force years down the road. So the Ministry of the Interior has been purged over and over and over again several times in the 90s. And then when Putin is able to put his substantial prestige behind even further reforms of the MOI, the old KGB is now relegated to the history books. The FSB is very young. The officers are very young. They came up under Yeltsin and Putin. They're a completely different bunch of guys than you had in the old KGB. So stop the nonsense that this is just a KGB in different packages. You know, I've read enough in Russian and in English that old bunch is now collecting a pension in what is very nice surrounding. Some of them are in Miami, some of them are in Rio, some of them are in the Crimea. It doesn't matter. They're gone. You know, I mean, you can only push that line for so long. The Ministry of the Interior has been radically reformed under Putin. Here is their portfolio, and I think this exists only in Russian, or I could be wrong about that. The portfolio, first and foremost, is the guarding of railways and all forms of communication. If an enemy power was to engage in, you know, breaking of, telephone lines, railways, and airports and everything else, the MOI would be in charge of counteracting that particular approach. Ministry of the Interior is also in charge of any evacuations in terms of natural disasters or poison gas attacks, or if a terrorist will use a bio agent against the Russian people. The Interior Ministry will be as part of its portfolio, will be in charge of any evacuation. If there is ever any need to declare martial law, and this has not been done, shockingly enough, over the last 20 years, the Interior Ministry will be in charge of implementing that. Lastly, the Ministry of the Interior is in charge of guarding nuclear plants and nuclear missile installations. Now, there was a fear back in the 90s that when the Russian government didn't have any money, that these nuclear scientists would be, you know, going off to different parts of the world, North Korea or wherever, and they were going to build nuclear weapons of, you know, every country that asked for them. The Ministry of the Interior has now been placed in charge, not merely in terms of nuclear power, but in charge of the scientific establishment specializing in nuclear weapons. Nuclear weapons guidance systems, radar, essentially, you know, all of those sort of things. And so what Putin has done, to restrict the independence of the MOI, is to make certain that even the basic training of MOI personnel is done alongside of the Ministry of Defense. And so Putin is really coming out vehemently opposed to the old Soviet system of having the MOD and MOI being two radically independent, very different states within states. So really, I mean, if you take anything away from this program, take that away. The idea that Putin is now realizing that one of the great errors of the Soviet system in terms of its bureaucracy is to really treat MOI and MOD as two separate things, not only two separate things, but that these two, you know, function completely apart from each other and became states within states. Putin refuses to permit that any further. The local security services, the so-called MES, this is your basic local security force that is also, you know, really has been established by Putin with the purpose of further restricting the portfolio of the MOI. And what we have with the MES is the prevention of disasters, both natural and man-made, search and rescue, and of course the Kursk disaster is something here very important, the collection of fines, and the dealing with any kind of social unrest, which in the Russian case has been relatively rare since the Putin economy has done, you know, fairly well for itself relative to the rest of the world. So that's something. So there is a separate, purely domestic security service dedicated entirely to dealing with local issues and local problems. This used to be an old KGB area, but Putin wants to make certain that the old MOI is very much kind of, you know, hemmed in by all of these other agencies. And so Putin's idea is that if I multiply agencies of state security and I control the purse strings, there won't be any state within a state like you used to have in the Soviet Union. The KGB, you know, has its own army, navy, air force. And they did, by the way. They even had their own nuclear installations. We can't have that anymore. We will not have this independent state within a state that decided who the president was and who, you know, sort of, it's, you know, old Roman Praetorian Guard kind of nonsense. And so then he creates the MES, which used to be integrated with the MOI, but that's not the case anymore. Okay. Let's conclude here, next few minutes, with the basic policies of all of this reform. I think you're getting, the basic approach here to military reform that Putin takes, very, very seriously. And Medvedev, you know, essentially being his student, takes seriously as well. Putin's idea is that at least at the military level, there is to be 10 full-strength divisions, active and highly mobile at all times. This means that if you have 10 full-strength divisions, you can fight a two-front war, at least for a limited period of time. Number two, that these are all professional forces. The Soviet Union used to have a draft for 18 months, that will be eventually phased out. And that all of these 10 full strength divisions, highly mobile, capable of going and fighting anywhere, are all professional soldiers who voluntarily enlist. But the 10 full strength divisions is a minimum. As more and more cash becomes available, and there's one thing that Russia has right now is cash, thanks to Putin, that can be increased. The 10 is the absolute minimum that no Russian president could ever feel secure going beneath. 10 full-strength divisions of various sorts, armor, infantry, communications, etc., you can't go underneath that. That all military equipment is unified. That there is a single manufacturer, or at the very least, a single standard, Russian standard, by which all military equipment is produced, and therefore everything is compatible with every other thing. And in an age of computerization, this becomes immensely important. In terms of infantry, Putin holds that 800,000 is the maximum. By the year 2010. And that you need, in terms of infantry, you need no more than 800,000 professional, highly trained soldiers and Marines, sailors, to make this new high-tech, military, function. And this is something common, especially in bureaucratic states, that the officer corps needs to be cut. Too many officers, not enough men. This is very common. That the maximum number of civilian personnel attached to regular military formations should never exceed 120,000. Putin is aware of the really increasing dependence of mercenary forces like Blackwater, who are not... Blackwater is very active in Iraq and Afghanistan. They're humiliating the United States because they are not subject to the Geneva Conventions. They are not subject to American law. They do whatever they want. And so they are assassination squads. If our nationalist people ever get put into prison, it's going to be the Blackwater Corps that patrols the borders. I'm absolutely convinced of that. And Putin is aware of that, and he knows that, and he's criticized the U.S. for that. So as a result, in terms of civilian personnel, nothing more than 120,000. and that whatever labor military or police forces require are strictly on a contract basis and absolutely positively nothing else, and that there's simply no requirement for anything other than that. So I want to say here now in conclusion that really there's several big issues. Border issues are absolutely central to this reform. Internal Russia is very stable and has been for some time. It's the border areas that historically and in terms of contemporary life have tormented the Russian state. Transparency and accountability of all military commanders as well as all bureaucrats is absolutely essential under the Putin regime. That much like, you know, you have this problem of, you know, dividing military forces according to targeted localities and their specific problems, you have on top of that targeted economic investment that follows these military districts. And that in the process of doing this, Putin will create an alternative, political, military, and economic, to NATO. And as I've said over and over and over again, it's not that nationalism or communism has ever been the problem for the Americans. The Americans will fight any entity that threatens to create an alternative trading bloc based on a currency other than the dollar. And the American political establishment will fight that war to the last drop of your son's blood to make certain that Goldman Sachs and the Rothschilds reign supreme throughout the world. The techniques of the computer age and the post-computer age and the nanotechnology age, that this is now incorporated into the Russian military system over the old bulk in terms of armor and manpower that the Russian army has relied upon in the past. And I'm not against the concept of what really I've been saying here for the last hour, that what Putin is doing is militarizing the reform of the civilian sector. That's nobody's fault. That is not Putin's fault. That is not Yeltsin's fault. That's the nature of attempting to reform a society that has yet to recover from the old Soviet mismanagement and really the violence of that era. And that Putin really is trying to synthesize the regions and the center. The regions really as the central focus, but never permitted to deviate exceptionally far from the policy of the center. And really the presidential envoy is very important in giving the regions a certain amount of power to deal with local problems and giving them a great degree of wiggle room, but never outside of presidential directives. So, and I think, you know, from an economic point of view, I think one thing that's happening is that Putin needs to create this backbone, this coercive military and police backbone to deal with one of the biggest problems in Russian life over the last 15 years, and that has been capital flight. The idea of the Jewish oligarchs shipping money overseas, investing it in the ADL, investing it in the Jewish Defense League and these other groups that have, you know, been the beneficiaries of some of these people in America. And, to bring some of that cash back into Russia, it belongs to Russia after all. It doesn't belong to the oligarchs. It doesn't belong to the Russian state. It belongs to the Russian workers. So, in terms of military reform, I think that we can summarize it all under three headings. Heading number one, operational task forces. This is really important, especially in the Russian language, where reformatting the military and police services to deal with specific issue areas, drugs, prostitution, foreign infiltration, the oligarchs, etc. Number two, joint logistics, that there cannot be interagency or intra-agency competition. We can't afford that. And number three, that the civilian police services and military services, particularly in the border regions, need to be integrated. They need to be integrated, and they need to serve the state. And the state, at least under Putin, remains a very, very popular and economically successful entity. And so Putin believes that he has earned the right to reformat military and security reform in Russia for the next several generations. And I think that what I've laid out here is very hard to find in English right now. I could be wrong about that, but I don't think it is. But I think that what we see is really what you need to do to consolidate a country that has gone through the fourth world, thanks to the United States and the Rothschilds, and is now trying to rebuild itself under extremely violent, John McCain, I know this from interviewing some of his staffers, some years ago, that he would go into rages and that he would smash equipment and he'd throw the fax machine across the room about how he's going to nuke Russia if he's going to be president and how he's going to, nuke most of the world when he becomes president. And so, the possibility of a McCain presidency or any neocon president in the future, Putin knows that he's under the gun quite literally here. In dealing with the American neocons and who are formally in allegiance with and alliance with the Jewish oligarchs from the former Soviet Union. Putin is, as a result of this reformation, at the forefront of fighting these people. And unlike the American right wing and the nationalists in America who have failed at every single thing they've ever tried to do, Putin has actually succeeded. And that might have something to do with some American hostility to him, but too bad. Most of you guys have failed. Pretty much anything you've ever tried to do, politically speaking, Putin has succeeded. So there. This has been the police and military backbone, the skeleton of the structure of the new Russia that Putin has succeeded in putting together, bringing Russia from third world status to first world status in 10 years. Let's see you guys do that. I appreciate you guys listening.
Thanks for listening. The Orthodox Nationalist returns Thursday evening, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Tuned into